This is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. A reminder that we're Zooming on Wednesday, so if something should happen on Wednesday night, we'll probably not be discussing it till Friday. As we're about to Zoom, though, I had the TV on, and I'm watching the pallbearers bring in Ruth Bader Ginsburg's coffin up to the Supreme Court. So if I'm a little bit weepy this morning, it's because I just have to honor this amazing being. Anyway, as we have begun every show, and the person that I honor is Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. When I heard his testimony during the impeachment hearings of 2019, I just stood up and went, oh my God, what a patriot, speaking truth to power, a celebration of immigration in America. And then of course, that powerful line that he used where he assured his father it would be all right. And I knew as soon as he said it, that it would not be all right. It would not be all right for him, for his twin brother, frankly, for the rest of us, not just the country, but the world. So in his honor, I want his voice ringing in your ears when you exercise the franchise this November of 2020. And now, testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
I have talked to Chuck Collins actually quite a bit over the course of my career. I got an email about a new release that just came out. It was entitled Billionaire Wealth Grew by $845 billion, or 29%, as Americans struggled through the first 6 months of the pandemic. They then go on to say, while millions lost jobs, businesses, health, and lives, the nation's 643 richest saw their collective fortune leap by nearly 30%. Chuck Collins joined us from the Institute for Policy Studies, where he looks on issues of inequality. This is your area of expertise. Sadly, but you have to develop a level of expertise, Chuck, on where the wealth is going, because it's not going to the masses. It's just going to the top. So let me welcome you to the program.
Arnie, great to be with you as always.
We've seen for the longest time that there's been this incredible growing gap between rich and poor. We know we haven't raised the minimum wage forever. We know that as the jobs began to disappear in the 1970s, when it was possible for one father to take care of a family, and I say a father because that's who was in the workforce, we suddenly saw incomes plummet. And I always tell people, Chuck, that the reason why the women's movement came at the right time was that the women's movement came when women were actually needed in the workforce. In the quote-unquote name of equality, I want a job too. I want to be equal like men. Well, guess what? They had to be in the economy because in order to pay the mortgage, in order to pay the bills, it wasn't going to happen on one salary. It needed two. And then I used to give speeches in the 1990s and I would say, we don't just need two, we need a menage a trois. Now we need a third person in order to sort of maintain people's standard of living. And then we just keep seeing the story get worse and worse. And then of course we had the 2008 economic meltdown that we all understand what brought about economic despair. And now as we thought we were beginning to crawl back, we get hit by the pandemic. But this story of this horrific, horrific human killing disease became an opportunity for billionaires to grow their wealth by $845 billion. You couldn't even imagine a more immoral story. how the heck did this happen?
It is a reflection of sort of how the rules of the economy are tipped in favor of people at the top. There is something twisted in addition to that. You know, you mentioned the 2008 economic meltdown. It took 2.5 years for the Forbes 400 for their wealth to get back to what it was in 2007, meaning even the wealthiest people in the society saw their wealth diminish. And as you pointed out, even going into this pandemic, half of U.S. households, I think, still had the economic hangover from the Great Recession. And in this case, this is, I think it's unprecedented that during a pandemic, when there is such a level of unequal sacrifice, that we're seeing almost a supercharging of the existing inequalities, meaning the billionaires that came into the pandemic are well positioned and have taken advantage of it and seen their wealth surge. And, you know, the bottom half and really the bottom 70% of households are losing ground and losing wealth. And it really is a human accident. I mean, there are ways in which we could have approached the pandemic that could have lifted people up and reduced inequality, but that's not been the program. So we're seeing an acceleration of inequality.
Not only is there an acceleration of inequality, but you know who will die. You know who will get sick. It won't be the 643 richest that will die and get sick for the most part. They can build a moat around themselves. Like Donald Trump, they can be tested every hour. Like Donald Trump, they can make sure that they're sort of left on sort of an island of health that they have created. And then the rest of us are not only left stranded economically, but we are suffering the consequences of the pandemic. And Chuck, the inequality is not just inequality of wealth and inequality of whether you live or die, but because of how we have developed a healthcare system, people that live having contracted COVID may end up having permanent conditions for the rest of their lives. So they not only suffer the consequences of being ill for maybe a couple of weeks or a couple of months, but that illness may last them a lifetime, which is going to have an economic depleting situation for them over the course of their lifetime. Because if you are sick, you can't earn as much. And if you're earning less to start, and then you carry this illness, guess what? Not only do you never catch up, but you're always being dragged backwards. I can point to the tax cuts of Donald Trump to say, look what we did. Look how we slashed the corporate tax. Look what we did for the wealthy, how we slashed the tax on the wealthy. That gave them a bump to start. But how did that bump not only get maintained, but in some ways, it seems like there was an enhancer on top of the cut.
Yeah, I mean, in this way, I agree with you, Arnie, in that this is both, it's the result of multi-generational inequalities, and it will reinforce those multi-generational inequalities going forward. And we could have had a healthcare system that, you know, was lifted up the bottom half of households, you know. I was just looking at how Vietnam, all these other countries of the world, invested in their public health systems in anticipation of a pandemic and have done incredibly well compared to the United States. Vietnam has done considerably better because they made a commitment to healthcare for all. I think we should understand that we failed to make investments in public health in the decades prior to this pandemic. We failed to do things to improve the well-being and standard of living for the bottom half of workers in this society. You know, decades of stagnant wages, depleting savings, declining home ownership. Those are like the pre-existing conditions and the racial wealth divide, the racial dimensions of inequality. These are the pre-existing conditions that we've entered this pandemic. And so those who had both the physical but also the economic disadvantages are, as you point out, carrying the load. They're dying or they're going to have lifelong impacts from this. And the wealthy have disconnected. They talk about social distancing. I call it economically distancing. They've withdrawn to bubbles and are riding this out and seeing their wealth surge. I mean, we're going to see the richest billionaire class, 640 people or so, hit the $1 trillion increase mark probably in the next month. $1 trillion of wealth increased since the middle of March. When people like Senator Sanders get out there and say, Well, why wouldn't we have an emergency pandemic wealth tax where you tax, you know, 60% of those gains? These people are going to be fine. They're going to still have billions more than they had at the beginning of the pandemic. Let's direct that to states and localities that are cutting services, laying off people. Let's direct it to healthcare. Let's direct it to the response so that we can have a proper response. Not such a far-fetched idea.
I think I just heard it this morning with the granddaughter of Disney saying basically exactly what you said. She said, tax me now. You know, she talked about a wealth tax now, because in a lot of ways, to delay is to harm the economy. To delay is to increase the opportunity for death. To delay, to be honest with you, Chuck, is to hurt those 643 richest people. They may have wealth, but what if they have wealth and they have no nation? What if they have wealth and they have no stability? What if they have wealth and they have no people who are going to be available to mow their lawns and to take care of them when they have a heart attack? Because they may not get COVID, but they do get heart attacks. You know, I'm beginning to look at them and going, what's the bubble worth? It's kind of like the Midas touch. You touch everything that turns gold. But when everything you touch turns gold, that includes your daughter. That includes your lawn mowers. Understand, gold doesn't feed you emotionally. You can't eat gold. Gold doesn't give you a quality of life in the long run. It may give you a pile of glitter, but it doesn't give you a life. And they are literally, with their accumulation of wealth, it means that wealth is coming from somewhere, and you know where it's coming from. It's coming from the bottom.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I think Abby Disney or the Patriotic Millionaires are people who are basically saying, look, it is in no one's interest, including the wealthiest people in the society, to keep going in this direction. That mythology that they're going to live in their bubble and that they're going to live disconnected from us, from an impoverished, degraded society, is a myth. We are all connected. It's not in the interest of these billionaires. And that's where a handful of them that have sort of recognized that and stepped up their giving. And a lot of them are just sitting on their treasure, and they're sitting on private family foundations with, you know, $1.2 trillion sitting in these private foundations. We actually, one of the things we've called for is what we call an emergency charity stimulus, which is to increase the statutory payout for these private foundations so that the rich aren't going to warehouse any more wealth. If they haven't figured out that this is the moment to share the money that they've already gotten tax breaks for giving, if this isn't the moment, when is? What are you waiting for your great-grandchildren to, give out wealth in the next famine and pandemic? You know, this is the moment. And if you can't figure that out, then we, the people, have to step in and provide a little nudge. You know, we're not going to subsidize private foundations that are just sitting on treasure.
You have in your release, between March 18th, the rough start date of the pandemic shutdown, when most federal and state economic restrictions were in place, and September 15th, the total net worth of the nation's billionaires rose from $2.95 trillion to $3.8 trillion. That works out to gains of $141 billion a month. $141 billion a month, or as you broke it down, $32 billion a week, or $4.7 billion a day. And we are looking at states hemorrhaging, and we're looking at cities hemorrhaging, and we're looking at families hemorrhaging, and we are talking about how many billions a day on top of their wealth. See, that's the thing, Chuck. They don't have just $4.7 billion a day. That is on top of the billions they already have. That, I think, is what is so mind-blowing about this, is that what is an economy for if only 643 billionaires seem to benefit from us and the rest do not? To me, if you want to invite unrest, these numbers invite unrest. If you want to invite instability, these numbers massage instability. And I have always used this ad nauseum, Calvin Coolidge's great line. My audience has heard me say it a million times. Calvin Coolidge was so smart. He said, you know what patriotism means? Patriotism means looking after yourself by looking after your country. And he got it. We're selfish animals. I get it. We care about me, myself, and I. But in the situation, especially with the pandemic and climate change and race relations and everything else, this is the one time, if you really do love yourself like you claim to do, you got to look outside yourself.
You and I talked about this a couple of years ago. I wrote this book, Born on Third Base, but my basic invitation to my fellow patriotic millionaires and billionaires was to come home. It's in your deep selfish interest to bring your wealth home, to bring it out of the shadows and the tax havens and bring it out of the warehouse foundations and bring it back to local economies and communities and invest in the common weal. That is in your deepest selfish interest to rejoin humanity, to be in the same boat, because you are, because we are. And I think one interesting thing is, if the billionaires can't figure it out, there is wild support for these proposals. I mean, the wealth tax, I just looked at new polling yesterday. Everybody thinks when you talk about taxes that you're going to scare everyone away. But when you talk about a wealth tax on people with $50 million or more to pay for healthcare, to pay for aid to state and local governments, these are proposals that have 80, 90% popularity among Republicans, independents, and Democrats. The American public is way ahead on this. We understand things are so out of balance and that we need corrective action. And it's not just where's the money going to come from. It's that you can't have a democracy, a healthy democracy, when so few people have so much wealth and power. And it's corrupting and corroding the American experiment. People get that.
So you started the conversation by talking about the countries that were successful in dealing with the pandemic. And you mentioned Vietnam. I think one of the reasons why I am so afraid about our healthcare system as it relates to billionaires is that there's no incentive for the wealthy to invest in public health because they can't make money on it. You see, they can make money on ventilators, and they can make money on hospital beds, and they can make money on drugs, and they can, but public health isn't about that really. Public health is about masks and social distancing and following, you know, someone who has the disease to see who they've talked to. It's not expensive in a lot of ways because it's so humanly based. There isn't a real kind of marketing for public health the way there is for private insurance and big pharma and the vaccines and everything else. Not that those things aren't important, but in the end, what may ultimately save all our lives, save the economy, I always say the pandemic is the economy, is that if we had spent the requisite money on public health and believed the scientists, we would all be better off with less death and less economic consequence. It doesn't mean that the billionaire still wouldn't have made a lot of money. You know that, Chuck. But it wouldn't be at the expense of everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's this powerful distinction between making some money and profiteering. And being a pandemic profiteer, you know, during World War II, you know, Harry Truman built his career by convening, the Truman Committee to oversee profiteering during the war and to essentially sort of sanction it and punish it and draw attention to it. You know, I think it was probably 20 years ago, Arnie, but you and I, I was working with Bill Gates' dad, Bill Gates Sr., who also died last week. Another great egalitarian, if you will. Passed at the age of 94. He was so clear. You know, he got the GI Bill when he was young to go to college and to go to law school. He understood we live in a common wheel. We live in a web. Things are so out of balance that it's not in anyone's interest. And you know, he said, progressive taxation, taxing wealthy people, is an economic opportunity recycling program. You know, if you are so fortunate that you've accumulated, you know, 50 million or 50 billion, you pay back the society so that we can continue to make the investments that made it possible for you to get that kind of wealth. He didn't believe anybody did it alone. And that's what good societies do. You see that web. And obviously women see that web more than men sometimes, you know, in terms of families and communities and networks. Some guys are out riding the rail saying, yeah, I did it all alone. I deserve all this wealth. I'm the smartest man in the universe, whatever. Bill was one of those people who gently punctured that myth and just said, no one does it alone. My son didn't do it alone. He did it because he lives in a society where together we make investments that make prosperity possible. And if you should be so fortunate to have that level of wealth, you pay it back, not just through charity, but through taxes. End of argument.
Who wrote the book Hawaii, the source? I'm having
Mishner? Was it Mishner?
James Mishner. James Mishner wrote an article at Parade magazine in 1992 or 1993. And I read that article and I literally had it, I think, in my hands forever. I've moved so many times that it's either been destroyed or lost. One of the things he talked about was that he said, I'm a knee-jerk liberal. My knee jerks when I see inequality. My knee jerks when I see people not being able to afford the food on their table. But then he talked about the proudest moments of his life was he lived in states that taxed him so that he would know that some of his wealth would be invested in his community's healthcare, in his state's welfare, in the ability of people to get to a job when they needed it. He said the most proudest thing was when he knew he lived in places that said, you're sharing part of your wealth with the rest of us. He said, that's what I'm on earth for. And it was an article at Parade magazine. And the fact that James Mishner was talking about taxes blew my mind, but that he connected it to something that was more important than just him. And that he was proud to do it because he understood what it meant, not just for him, but for the well-being of the people that he lived with. And to him, that was the most important thing. I'll never forget that, Chuck. I've got to find the article at Parade Magazine and send it to you. That he would mention that to me was just so shocking. Before I let you go, I talked a little bit about the public health piece. We talked about the billionaire wealth growing by $845 billion or 29% since the pandemic began. But I got to ask a question. Is there something in the sort of gender conversation that we need to have as well? Because I'm looking at some of the numbers coming out of Iowa, for example, where the difference between women and men is a 20% differential in support of, for example, Biden or Trump or Joni Ernst or whatever. I'm wondering, is it because men have accumulated this wealth for so long? They have been sort of at the top of the heap that what they fear is that somehow they're going to have to share it. And it's not just that they fear sharing it with other men. They fear sharing it with the rest of us, i.e. women as well. And I'm wondering if there's also a gender component here.
I think there is. I mean, I said that I think that myth that I did it alone is sort of a male, you know, it's kind of the disconnected, wounded male story of the world. You know, I'm out here on my own and I'm everything I do, all the rewards I receive are all of my own doing. I was born in a state of nature and raised by wolves. Whatever. It's sort of like that. I would just say to my fellow men, it's like, it's entirely in our own interest and our own liberation, if you will, to see that we're part of a web and to invest in the web, not just in our own little bubble and mythology. It's refreshing when people break out of it and you hear, whether it's James Mishner or other people saying, yeah, you know, I didn't do it alone. I wasn't raised in a state of nature. I'm part of a society. I'm part of public investments and community and coaches and mentors and teachers and librarians and people who helped me. When you see that web, you can't unsee it.
When I look at Donald Trump's message, his messaging is to white male supremacy. That is the essence of his message. And when I look at how the numbers in Iowa were so radically different, and then I look at the 643 people who have seen their wealth grow by $845 billion since the beginning of the damn pandemic, and I'm beginning to look at the names. There's a lot of boys on that list. You begin to sort of realize that that's what Donald Trump is doing. He's massaging their ego. He's massaging their machismo. He's massaging the idea that they did it on their own. And what I think this pandemic and climate change and Black Lives Matter and the wheels falling off is that they can't survive alone, Chuck. They can't fight all their billions. Thank you so much for joining us. Chuck Collins is with the Institute for Policy Studies. He's an expert in inequality. Unfortunately, he's got too much on his hands. Thank you so much, John.
Thanks, Arnie.
You're welcome. All right, everyone, stick around. We'll be right back. Bob Hennelly has written the fabulous piece at Salon.com. He joins us next.
Digital Wassailing at its finest. It's Happy Holidays Week, and you're on the Soundbeat. Bob Wells didn't set out to write a classic when he envisioned the Christmas song.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire.
He was just trying to stay cool. He started writing the lyrics on an unbearably hot summer day and hoped to employ a little wintry mind over matter. Co-writer Mel Torme noticed snippets of the now iconic sentences in Wells' notebook. They got to work, and today it is one of the most recorded and most loved holiday tunes of all time.
Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright. Tiny tots with eyes all aglow will find it hard to sleep tonight.
You're listening to Nat King Cole, of course, but this version they may not be the one you're familiar with. The 1961 recording is usually considered definitive. This one, however, was recorded in 1946. Check out more holiday classics at soundbeat.org. Soundbeat is produced at the Belfer Audio Archive, Syracuse University Library. I'm Brett Barry.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazarus, and this is Climate Connections. Richard Mabian is an environmental activist and president of the Kansas City, Kansas branch of the NAACP. He says it's important to engage low-income communities in climate action.
We don't have a total effort in this country to deal with the reduction in our greenhouse gas. We're just spinning our wheels in mud.
But a lack of trust can be a barrier. He says too often, strangers come to a community to do outreach, but then they leave just as people are getting to know them. And in environmental groups, Mabian frequently finds he's the only black person in the room.
So that means that we still have people that are non-persons of color feeling they are capable of going into those neighborhoods where there's a lack of trust and making a difference.
So he suggests finding community partners. For example, he worked with the Sierra Club on an energy efficiency campaign in Kansas City. The group gave him background materials. Then he gave presentations to the community. Mabian says this train-the-trainer approach builds trust and a more effective climate movement. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Welcome back to part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, a reminder that we are Zooming on Wednesday morning. So we love Bob Henley. Bob Henley writes for The Chief Leader, InsiderNJ.com. He is at Stuck Nation, but we also read a lot about him at Salon.com. And his most recent piece at Salon.com was entitled, Nations Who Have Recovered Fastest, Quarantine the Fastest. The ruling elites won't allow that here. Both parties are to blame for the economic rot precipitated by corporations and the super rich. Bob, I want to welcome you to the program, but before you start talking, we just did an interview with Chuck Collins, and Chuck Collins was talking to us about the growth in wealth of the billionaires since the beginning of the pandemic, which, by the way, has increased by $845 billion just since the beginning of the pandemic. I was talking about the gender differential, and that in an interesting way, most of those billionaires are male, that males somehow think that they've done it on their own. They are here to create wealth and basically to amass wealth. And we were talking about the sort of the gender difference. And it reminded me of the opening of your great piece at Salon.com that we're going to be talking about today. So with your permission, I want to read the first couple of sentences.
Of course.
Every campaign pitch is at its root a narrative, a storyline about the ebb and flow of our history that acts as an orientation for the vote that is upon us. The candidate whose storyline captures the most people is the one that prevails in November. For Trump's base, the Make America Great Again cult, our nation achieved its zenith in the post-World War II era when a white family could be supported by a single breadwinner. For them, Donald Trump, just on the verge of restoration of those halcyon days when the Chinese unleashed the coronavirus and wrecked what he called the greatest economy in history. And now, as the pandemic body count passes 200,000, many MAGA voters believe the virus is a hoax, and public health measures that aim to stop its spread are part of a deep state conspiracy to deprive Americans of their fundamental civil liberties while kneecapping Donald Trump, who is in the process of delivering that so-called greatest economy. So deeply held is this conviction, these folks believe that letting their fellow Americans succumb to the virus is a reasonable trade-off, because the more people that die and the faster the virus spreads, the quicker herd immunity will be conferred on a grateful nation who can resume in basking in Trump's restoration of white male greatness. Welcome to the program, Bob Henley.
Well, thanks for reading it.
Oh, my God. That is exactly how we ended the conversation with Chuck Collins. How could I not start with that? You captured exactly the essence of the Trump message. And if every woman in America doesn't hear it, I will give them all a knuckle sandwich, Bob Henley. So talk about your piece. It's incredible because, again, you do weave so many interesting facts to sort of paint this picture.
I think the most important thing here, because time is really short, to save us from the calamity of Trump's reelection or his creating such a stir that he stagnates the process of him leaving office in the happy circumstance that Mr. Biden wins. The biggest lie he's telling that is killing people as we speak is that the only way through prosperity to prosperity is to ignore COVID and to accept as collateral damage and a down payment on the prosperous future of America 200,000 lives, which were close, probably closer to 350,000 by the time election rolls around. And so this is done by looking at data that's available, international data that shows that Denmark's, the South Korea's, the New Zealand's, the places that responded quickest and were most serious about that response and put in place broad-based public health measures are the ones that have limited and proved to be more resilient in terms of their macroeconomy. Here in the United States, while we can say that the decline in the economy isn't as bad as other places, if you factor in the death, and the other thing that's just not discussed at all is the long-term disability issues here. This is something that I don't think the Biden campaign is sufficiently depicting for Americans.
I totally agree about that. I said something the other day, and I actually even called my producer, and I said, maybe you want to edit this out, because I don't want it to sound as harsh as how I said it. But what I said, and I think it goes to your point, and that is that we will have hundreds of thousands of deaths. It will not end at 200. It will not end at 350. It will be far in excess, I suspect, of around 500,000 to 600,000, if we're lucky. If we're lucky, because, you know, everyone's putting everything into a vaccine that we're not sure is going to work. We know a lot of people that have already decided they don't want to take the vaccine. And the best crude vaccine we have right now is a mask and Donald Trump literally fights the mask. He literally fights the mask. You're a sissy if you wear a mask. And you just saw a huge event outside for him, a huge event. And the number of people that were wearing a mask, you practically count on your hands and your toes. I'm looking at this, and what I said was, as horrific as the death is, and we keep doing the death count, it is going to be the living count that will end up compromising us in perpetuity. And that's because those that survive COVID are going to be carrying pre-existing conditions, heart, lung, nervous system, brain, things that don't happen with the flu. They don't happen with the common cold. They don't happen when you get strep throat. These are permanent conditions that are going to not only cost the healthcare system trillions and trillions of dollars, but it's going to cost those families a huge economic loss. Because if they have to care for someone because they had contracted COVID, that's a loss of their economic opportunity. Right. It means families' economic opportunity is going to have to be diverted into caring for that someone. So we are now looking at an economic hole that we have never had to factor in before. And not only is Biden not talking about it, but nobody really is. And that's the really evil, dirty little secret, is that dying ends a conversation. But with COVID-19, living is where the worst of worst begins to unravel.
Right. And that, and part of the problem is that we have a legion of reporters following every iteration and gyration of Wall Street. But in the retrenchment of media and the news media, we do not see labor reporting. And as we've said before on this show, labor is the key part of this story. And so my mandate and obligation of the chief leader is to cover every day 24/7 the granular personal circumstance of the people that answer the 911 line, the people that are the ambulance EMTs, the detectives that photograph dead bodies that happen in people's homes from COVID. And so it's in that experience, which I just can't seem to get national traction on. I appreciate your help, but nobody really wants to tell the story about the court officer who lost his arm from a blood clot, who survived COVID, or the former head of the Uniformed Postal Police officers who was consigned to a walker. And so because we don't have a sense of the real damage here, it's a missed opportunity. I mean, Biden needs to be talking about a robust economic expansion that is rooted in doing all the things for public health that we forgot about. And that means also bringing back the narrative about the pandemic to the years that led up to it, which include the closing of scores of urban and rural hospitals where poor people lived, the decision to spend hundreds of billions of dollars on wars we could never win, and on top of that, the abandonment of the public health lessons, like something like, let's have a nurse in every school, shall we? That's vintage 1918. And we decided to unlearn that. So Mr. Biden needs to explain how this is the new deal, the postmodern covenant, that will include getting rid of fossil fuels because you can't really breathe well with COVID if you've got forest fire smog in your lungs, and tied into flipping Donald Trump's wealth pyramid so that essential work is not taxed at a higher rate as it is today than idle capital.
You have an interesting piece in your piece about feudalism. Because I keep looking at the 643 billionaires who just saw their wealth grow, and I keep thinking about that 1% as kind of being feudal lords.
This is Richard Wolff's quote, right?
This is Richard Wolff. It's fabulous. I want people to hear it, because in a lot of ways we are serfs. In a lot of ways they are the feudal lords. They do own everything. And when you think about what's happening with this economy, not only do you see the wealth going to them, but if you lose your house, guess who's going to buy your house? One of those billionaires, and they're going to buy it at a discount rate. I mean, just think about this. All your equity, all your life savings, if you can't pay the rent or pay the mortgage, you lose. You have to walk away. But who's there to scoop it up? Trust me, it's not going to be your next door neighbor. It's going to be one of these feudal lords. And here's what Richard Wolff writes. This is like an incredible analogy, but I think people, they like the Middle Ages. They get the Middle Ages. Richard Wolff is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts. He describes the U.S. failure to control the spread of the pandemic and the economic fallout. And he said it harkens back several hundred years in Europe to the collapse of feudalism. And I'm thinking, where are you going with this? But actually, he makes sense. In the 14th century Europe, the Black Death pandemic began the end of feudalism because millions of serfs were too dead or too sick to produce the surpluses paid as rent to their feudal landlords, writes Wolf. That rent supported the entire political and cultural structures of European feudalism. They consequently crumbled and took the system down. Today, tens of millions of unemployed, on top of all the dead and sick, are likewise depriving our capital system of the surpluses, profits, etc., that support our political and cultural institutions. The disintegration of capitalism, especially where the death, sickness, and unemployment are worse, i.e. the U.S., is furthest along. I thought that was just
genius. I got to link you guys together. You could just burn down an hour very quickly.
But it's so important because you keep saying, what is he not talking about? And one of the things I said to Chuck Collins in the first half of the show was that these rich people don't get it. They're hurting themselves. Eventually, they are also going to be destroyed because they haven't made the right investment in what is going to ultimately be in their long-term best interest, which is a healthy, economically stable place where people can earn a living, take care of their family, and buy their crap.
Well, that would be the lesson that Henry Ford had, the essential observation about paying people sufficiently to buy that which they're producing. I do feel that I need to give an example of a super billionaire who you know I have no love for, but I must give some props to Michael Bloomberg and his decision to pay the fines for, I think, 13,000 was the last count.
32,000,
right. Of folks in Florida who have paid that debt to society, and then the legislature tried to come up with a poll tax by holding them to paying their fines. God bless him for doing that. There's no better use for that fortune than for him to do something like that. And if he can continue that, I think that he will be making a living legacy.
And let's remind everyone. So Bloomberg has already said that he's going to spend $100 million just in Florida, okay? He already said, I mean, this is a guy, $100 million for him, he earns in an hour. I mean, that's like, this is not a lot of money for him. But it is a lot of money when you're talking about the context of politics. And when you realize what the Republicans did with the ex-felons in Florida that had been overwhelmingly given by the people, their vote restored, okay? It was a huge, it was a referendum. It passed by amazing numbers in Florida, everyone. And then the Republican legislature said, do we want these people to be able to exercise the franchise? So they decided to go beyond the will of the people and say, but before you get to exercise the franchise, you have to pay off all your fines and all the money you owe. Here's the kicker, Bob. They don't even know exactly how
right.
many people
I forgot
owe.
To mention that. That's
they
right.
Forgot to mention. They don't even know. They're just saying you owe money, and until you pay us back, which we don't know how much, you can't vote. So the brilliance of what Bloomberg did by saying, okay, those people don't have the money they need, by at least allowing 32,000 fines to be paid off, that means those are 32,000 people that can vote in November, because I think the end of registration is like early October. Right. So we had to do it now. And the problem is, why only 32,000? Because he probably can't figure out exactly how much the others owe, because even the state of Florida don't know.
This is a convergence of the economic inequality, the need for redress that is being brought forward so poignantly by Black Lives Matter. This is what we refer to as reconstructive justice, restorative justice at its core. If you look at the fact that so many of people that find themselves up jammed up, this is the result of the drug war. You know, as a matter of fact, Biden should make a much bigger deal out of this, because this would go some way to heal his own record that is so wanting when it comes to the crime bills that he passed. So, yeah, I do think, though, that he needs to really have, and I've heard, I have to say that in the town hall meetings and in the speeches, I do like the way Biden has cast himself as Scranton Joe. I think that his whole riff of talking about, I guess, a reporter asked the vice president if he realized that he'd be the first president in recent memory who will not have graduated from an Ivy League college. All of that goes to outflanking and reclaiming the mantle of the working class, the Democratic Party coming out of the New Deal should have had. And it lost its way because of some of the detachment from the Obama years and even from the Clintons. Right. And so I think that that's the path that Joe has to go on. And he needs to look, remind people of Donald Trump, who exploited undocumented Polish immigrants, put their lives at risk when he was doing the demolition work in New York City, the way he left tradespeople high and dry in Atlantic City with such a reckless disregard.
So, Bob, you cover public sector unions, especially in New York. We've been talking a lot about the police unions that are coming out for Donald Trump. I think we need to also talk about the fact that they are actually acting in their worst self-interest, because you constantly are talking about the personal stories, and you're always talking about the number of deaths with EMTs and cops and firefighters, and the support of Trump, where he's embracing really the concept of herd immunity, the idea that people are expendable. What the cops need to know is it's them.
Right.
They are in the forefront of being in places where if the pandemic is roaring back, they catch it. They're right. In the forefront of being in places where they are going to be so vulnerable to not surviving. Look at the age of a lot of them. Some of them even still have pre-existing conditions. Look at the numbers of how many have already died. Right. How come Joe has not looked at them and said, don't you get it? You are the expendable. And he's even told you, but you can't hear it.
There was a reference he made off extemporaneously about the number of police officers and deputy sheriffs that have died from COVID being more than those shot on the job. But the other thing to keep in mind here is that I do believe the Democratic Party has to take the fight to the PBA union halls, because particularly in a place like New York City, in my lifetime, we now have a majority of the police officers are officers of color, an increasing presence of women. And also, when you get down to the occupation level, there's tremendous tension on the job. Imagine, and these are real world circumstances, where you are a police officer, a detective, or a patrol person who finds themselves with a dear relative living with you, an elderly person with a pre-existing condition. You are wearing your mask, and you're wearing it all the time, and you have to be partnered with an absolute jerk who will not wear his mask because it's a sign of civil liberties and he supports Donald Trump. That's what's happening. And you need to get in that patrol car and you need to draw that out.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. And you write it in your piece. You say, while the pandemic hit America's working class families, particularly in communities of color, where they're struggling to recover from the ground they lost as consequences of the Wall Street-induced Great Recession, they also, and listen to these words, they also disproportionately make up the ranks of the essential workforce, cops, police, are you listening? The essential workforce who would have to just suck up the additional health risks to themselves and their families that comes with being an essential worker. I really do think he needs to get into the union halls. He needs to talk to them and say, the more this pandemic rages, the less testing that we do, the less social distancing that we encourage, the less mask wearing, it is you that dies. It is your family that is expendable. He doesn't have your back. He's got a bullet in your back, and it's called COVID.
And the other thing is they call it the invisible bullet is a phrase that the detectives union used in New York City, who lost 6 detectives. One of the other things that's happening right now is because the Republicans have refused to come up with the round of aid for local, county, and state governments, we're now seeing, well, roughly 1.5 million public workers have been laid off in this essential sector we've just discussed. So now, on top of it, they're going to be dealing with a Christmas and holiday where they stand the chance of worrying about layoffs. And so we're already seeing where Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell's direct assault on local blue states' governance is resulting in potentially laying off, like in New York City, they've discussed 400 EMTs, which would be 10% of the workforce. The numbers just came out. The deterioration of public services that's coming from this assault from the federal government, which is at this point a predator state in my mind. And actually, they are trying to actually withdraw already appropriated money. under all kinds of ridiculous things like calling it an anarchist jurisdiction, a sanctuary city. This is a direct assault where the host that we have been feeding and blue states have been feeding the federal government for years, more than they got back, is now turning on these city states to undermine them, destroy them, and send them into chaos.
You talk about the fact that we should get into the union halls. I am trying to look at the police unions that has endorsed Donald Trump. And as you just described the numbers that he is draining out of these cities and these states, where he's pointing to them, that's their salary. That's their job. Right. That's their lives. Do they get it?
Some of them are so, and part of this has to do with it. So much of it, we've permitted law enforcement to become socially alienated from the main culture. And this is something I've observed because while we deinstitutionalize the mentally ill across the country and the homeless grew to like, you know, hundreds of thousands and they congregated where? In places of mass transit. We had the police deal with the basic implosion that happened in terms of America's social and public health circumstance. This deterioration, Arnie, has been years in the making. It's important to remind people that for 3 years in a row, we had a declining life expectancy here in the United States. We've dropped dozens of spots globally in terms of the life expectancy, which is considered a benchmark for public well-being. And the elites ignored this deterioration. Who was there to witness it and told to deal with it? Cops. And so it either turns you into, like me, a Dorothy Day Marxist, or it sends you the other way, thinking like you're a reactionary who's alone fighting the last battle of the great white man. Creates that response.
You're absolutely right. The burden's now being placed on cops to be social workers and mental health counselors and try to figure out what to do with the homeless, where they, I mean, what do? You shift them from one block to another. That's not a solution. You're then shifting them back to another. So there's never a sense of closure. There's never a sense of accomplishment. You just want them to disappear. I mean, let's be honest. That is your only answer because you're not given any resources or tools to deal with it. And frankly, you shouldn't be dealing with it.
Right.
But you know what? I'm hearing the exact same story you just told about the cops with guess who else? Teachers.
Right. Right.
Teachers are saying the same thing. We are the dumping ground for society's failure. You don't feed them, we feed them. You don't clothe them, we clothe them.
Right.
You don't take care of their health, we take care of their health. When you think about this, you have teachers and you have cops, and they are the canary in the coal mine. They are living it. And yet it's so interesting because once again, teachers tend to be more female, cops tend to be more male. Look at the difference in the response.
Well,
teachers are looking at Joe Biden and, you know, investing in education and the economy and healthcare. And where are the cops going? The cops are going to the white supremacists.
And it's a mixed bag. You do have the case of like the International Association of Firefighters, which is the international union for all the firefighters in the country, was the first union to endorse Joe Biden. What this speaks to, and this is what Biden has to connect the dots, and it's going to be difficult because it means also being honest about the 8 years of President Obama, is that there has been a broad deterioration in the circumstance of the American people where it matters. It's no accident that the Federal Reserve told us before the pandemic that some 40% of Americans would have a hard time finding $400 laying around to cover an emergency expense. And so the elites have ignored this as wealth concentration accelerated and as corporate profits were permitted to increasingly be stashed offshore. And so we can't be surprised with the deterioration. And I would say before, I know we're coming short on time, but one of the things to keep in mind is there was great reporting by Rachel Maddow recently just this week about how the CDC watered down their guidance for the meat plants. And remember that President Trump, who was loath to use the Defense Production Act for creation of, you know, PPE or anything else, extended it to force meat companies to be able to stay open no matter what objections came from local public health officials. This created a huge problem in terms of COVID going off the charts. What Maddow has documented is that the CDC issued very strict guidance and then it was watered down after Sonny Perdue, the slash cabinet agricultural lobbyist. And so as a result, though, what's missed is that federal workers are dying, and I do believe meat and poultry inspectors, we need to talk about bringing another impeachment, articles of impeachment against Donald Trump for what he's done to the federal workforce.
And on that note, Robert Henley writes for Salon.com, as well as the chief reader, as well as at Stuck Nation, the title of his piece, Nations Who Have Recovered Fastest, Quarantined the Fastest. The ruling elites won't allow that here. Thank you so much for joining us, Bob. Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll see you tomorrow.